The Labour Party's Peter Mandelson once remarked that Labour was intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich. But in 2019, a politician is more likely to be heard saying we must all be deeply concerned about the apparent excesses of pay at the top of organisations, both public and private sector. But do they have a point? Many argue that the current requirement for large businesses to spell out the basis of their pay structure may be acceptable, and find maintaining a watchful eye on pay in the public sector to be eminently sensible. But are those calling for the state to have the power to fix pay ratios or even introduce pay caps at risk of ignoring the numerous downsides which come from government intervention? Well, fortunately, a new IEA publication debates these very issues, with Top Dogs and Fat Cats, the debate on high pay, launched this week. It looks at all aspects of the high pay debate and features chapters debating the rights and wrongs of CEO pay, the links between corporate governance and executive pay, and the gender pay gap in executive roles. It features contributions from leading academics and economists and was brought together by IEA editorial research fellow Professor Len Shackleton. Joining me to discuss the topic is Len himself and Luke Hildyard of the High Pay Centre, a UK think tank carrying out research and analysis on issues relating to top incomes, corporate governance and business performance. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Len, I wanted to ask you, isn't it right for the High Pay Centre to argue that major UK companies benefit from government support in multiple ways, whether that be direct subsidies and tax breaks, and therefore it's reasonable for the public to expect the government to set certain expectations of them?
I think what you talk about there, Darren, is some notion of crony capitalism. I think there's a lot to be said for that argument, actually. But trying to attack all companies through the kind of measures which are being suggested, is this just being, it's not really focused on what the real problem is. I think there are a lot of, to be fair to the Labour Party on this, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, when he's talked about this, has been very interested in focusing on companies which do a lot of business with the government. I mean, thinking particularly of outsourcing companies like Capita and so forth, who, of course, have been in the news for the various malpractices and problems with the collapse of Carillion and so forth. And that may well be something which needs to be addressed. But I don't think that's quite quite a reason for an attack right across the board on listed companies.
And what would be the consequence then of these pay restrictions on the market for CEOs?
Part of Luke's chapter is that he doesn't think it would have much impact. I think he probably underestimates this. You talk, Luke, of how a lot of promotion of people to CEO comes from within companies. Yeah, that's true. But they're operating in an international market, nevertheless. And something like 40% of FTSE 100 company CEOs are in fact non-UK nationals. They are part of a much wider market. So I think we have to be a little concerned about that. The other thing is, with all these kind of indicators which we're asked to look at, and this includes gender pay gaps as well as these company pay ratios, they are capable of being manipulated in various ways. And one of the problems which I think you have in this area is that, first of all, it's the requirements are based on companies with more than 250 employees, so it's possible to manipulate that by outsourcing, for example. If you manage to outsource most of the low-paid work, then this enables you to boost the pay of the people at the top. So I'm very unhappy about these kind of hard and fast ratios. Mm. Even more so, of course, if you try to put an absolute cap on pay, which has been suggested in some quarters.
Luke, part of Len's points, where he's right, isn't he, that we live in a more globalised world and a decision made by a CEO today impacts more than just UK workers. Instead, it impacts the lives of everyone involved in that global supply chain. So doesn't that actually justify a higher pay packet?
It's a good argument for one. I think the sort of flip side of that is that CEOs have become more dependent. I mean, we wrote a a chapter, an essay collection even, looking at the impact of CEOs on company performance. And it's a very sort of esoteric area, because it's quite hard to sort of separate the performance of the company from the, you know, the economic context, the contribution of the wider workforce, etc. So I think it's something that people debate quite strongly. But we did speak to a lot of people at the top who have personal experience of running big companies. He said, frankly, in many cases, it's a complete potluck. You take a decision on the advice of other people. Sometimes it works out for you, and you know, and sometimes it doesn't. When you're running an operation with tens of thousands of employees on multiple continents, it's very hard to have a, you know, for one individual to have a complete handle on that. And it's in some ways the sort of globalization has meant the sort of single individuals are less important. And as Sir Philip Hampton put it in our publication, I better make sure I get the quote right, it's the bigger the system, the more the system, it's more the system that counts than the people at the top of it. And I think one thing that's sort of quite telling in respect to this is, on the one hand, you have the argument, and as I say, it's a valid argument, that you know, these are people in huge jobs employing thousands of people, companies with capitalization in the billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions, so they deserve to be paid very well. Then on the other hand, if something goes wrong, I'm thinking sort of, you know, all the countless scandals you've had in the banking industry, health and safety issues in oil and gas and commodities companies, the response from the CEOs is often, we run huge companies with tens of thousands of employees all over the world, we can't possibly be expected to keep a handle on everything. So I think the sort of size and scalability argument sort of cuts both ways a bit.
Is that right, Len? Do you think there's a bit of hypocrisy around it? Is any one individual as important as suggested?
Well, I think individuals, where something goes wrong, eventually individuals do get heaved out, and that's part of the corollary, really, of high pay, is it's high risk, and the number of CEOs who have lost their jobs in recent years has been increasing, you know, not just in Britain but in the United States as well, and in other countries. And as for whether these people are really worth these large sums of money, well, you know, the market does seem to pay some attention to what's going on. When a leading CEO leaves for another job, you do get changes in share prices and so on, which run, of course, because of the huge shareholdings, of course, run into billions of pounds worth of change in share prices. So clearly the market is, you know, surprised by these things and responds to it in some way. Again, if we get drawn, and you know, people often talk about football managers and things like this in this kind of context, and clearly the Pep Guardiola or somebody like that, right, is part of a team of people. And if Manchester City blow up and lose the, you know, it won't be down to him. It'll be down to the players. It'll be down to the coaches and all this kind of stuff. Nevertheless, the people at the top are paid very well, and nobody is going around saying that we shouldn't pay Paul Pogba £50 million a year as a footballer.
Better on Man United fans. Well,
you know, that's life. Obviously, yeah. Big organisations are teams, but that doesn't mean that the people at the top are dispensable or easily replaced. Like sort of Lego parts or something, just plug another one in, it's very difficult to find these people. The market gets it right, the market gets it wrong, you know, but that's true of all type of economic activity.
So Luke, I want to know what the High Pay Centre thinks that the public interest angle is, because surely if shareholders are missing a trick and overpaying their chief execs, who loses out from that? Surely it's the shareholders themselves, isn't it?
People consistently say in opinion polls that they would prefer they would willingly sacrifice economic growth for greater equality. And I'm sure, like, the IEA would have very strong, sort of, take a very strong view on that. And, you know, and it's certainly a sort of debatable proposition. I don't know if I'd agree with it, but it does seem to be what people think. So there is a kind of, if you think that sort of, you know, government policy should be responding to what people want to do, and I certainly don't think they should be responding to, you know, every opinion poll, but there is a clear, a literal sort of public interest. As I say, we're kind of concerned with the sort of distributional angle and what this means in terms of economic inequality. And again, I totally appreciate that many people are sort of less concerned with that, as long as sort of everybody is generally, you know, their living standards are going up, you know, whatever the sort of relative speeds of those at the top, in the middle and at the bottom. We personally are sort of more concerned with the sort of distributional effects, but also the extent to which what I was talking about at the beginning, pay it for those at the top has come at the expense of those at the bottom, and, you know, to what extent redistribution or pre-distribution could play in raising incomes of those in the middle and at the bottom. I think if you look sort of historically at what's raised living standards, it's been a mixture, hasn't it, of sort of growth and innovation, and also measures to kind of distribute or share that growth as sort of fairly as possible.
Do you think that's right, Len? Because there clearly is this public interest in high in CEO pay. Do you think that if something isn't done, to coin a phrase, that there'll be more sort of reactionary measures taken? There'll be more perhaps government invitation in government intervention rather, in a way in which is even more severe than's been suggested now.
Well, there is that kind of slippery slope argument you could bring into that, of course. But I, you know, obviously, we, if the public really wants something, then, you know, in a democratic system, they should get it. But economists tend to pay more attention to reveal preference to what people actually do when they're actually faced with the decision. And the idea that people want to sacrifice economic growth mm-hmm. for greater equality, well, that's an easy thing to say when you're asked a question, you know, you do something on the internet or something, press a button, yeah, I, you know, a bit of virtue signalling there, I'm a nice person, I think we should redistribute. Mm-hmm. But when it actually comes to people's behaviour, you know, people are influenced by their families, what they, you know, what their income is, are they going to grow, are they going to be able to afford a house, are children going to be looked after, and so forth. So, you know, I would look at what people actually do rather than what they say in this kind of area, I think.
The High Pay Centre, we're absolutely clear now at this point in the podcast that the High Pay Centre thinks CEOs are paid too much. I think that's fair
yes.
to say.
Yes.
But how much would be the right amount? Because, you know, I've been through your report, I've been through your website, and you don't say,
yeah.
you don't suggest any real way of knowing. You emphasise multiples of employees' pay on your website, but there's no reason at all to think that it would be a good way of judging how much a CEO is worth to a firm, and it doesn't make sense across firms. So, for example, the CEO of a giant firm with a low average wage, think McDonald's or Tesco, how would they have their pay restricted more than a CEO of a relatively small firm with a high average wage, like Kintech, for example? You know, how are you measuring that? What's the right
pay? Yes, so I think people would clearly look at you know, look at it by sector, and as you say, you wouldn't say compare the pay ratio of JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs with loads of really well-paid bankers with McDonald's, where they have published the CEO to median pay ratio, and I think it's a restaurant worker in Warsaw is the median McDonald's employee. So I think firstly the sort of sector comparisons would be the sort of the interesting ones, and it would be interesting to see how those with a very high ratio within a sector in terms of financial performance and, you know, and other forms of performance compared with those with the low ratio. We tend to sort of shy away of saying there should be a cap of sort of 5-1, 10-1, 20-1, or whatever. Peter Drucker, the management expert, did actually say 20-1. I think way back in whatever BC, Plato said 5-1, not including slaves. So I wouldn't like to sort of give a precise number. I think it's, as I said earlier, it's more about having confidence in the sort of governance of the pay setting process. And, you know, what we have reservations about is, you know, the distance between the sort of providers of capital, the the sort of shareholders, the pension savers, and the people who actually are stewards of it on their behalf, and the kind of sort of the types of people who set the pay packages, their conscious and unconscious conflicts of interest and stuff, and the kind of narrow pool of stakeholders who have a say in that process. So if you had, you know, we always advocate worker representation on boards. I think it would be a lot. I think it would be a lot easier for companies to say, okay, you might not like the fact that we're paying our CEO this much, but the company's workforce have had their say in the process, and they clearly, on the one hand, want to have a sort of fair distribution of pay internally, but also want to keep hold of a CEO who's securing their jobs for the future or whatever.
So, Len, I want to put that back to you then. How much is too much?
I think this is something which should be left up to companies to decide, basically. An issue which you might want to think about, though, is suppose we manage to impose some kind of ratio like this, and the 20-to-1 you mentioned, of course, is what Jeremy Corbyn wants to do. If you held all these CEOs and similar people in private companies and so forth to these kind of levels, the implication, of course, would be that the tax take would fall quite dramatically. And in order to maintain the existing level of public expenditure, then tax rates would have to rise for people lower down the income. And it'd be interesting to see if that kind of question is posed to people in these kind of YouGov surveys and so forth, where they all want to be virtue signalers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, the argument would be that if the having a ratio publicised creates A, an incentive to reduce pay at the top, but B, to increase it for those at the bottom as well, in order to, you know, make your ratio look more publicly acceptable. So hopefully there would be there would certainly be an incentive to raise pay for low and middle earners. Part of the reason, of course, that those at the top pay so much in taxes, you know, and this is something that in income tax that they do, that the top 1% pay a vastly disproportionate share, is that they do also take a very large share of total incomes. So if you had the share of incomes going to those at the top reduced, then yeah, their share of total tax would be reduced, and you might have to tax those at the bottom more, but it would be on a higher share of total incomes as well.
I noticed that the High Pay Centre cites Volkswagen as one of their success stories for putting workers on boards, better worker representation. Now, I mean, it's hardly...
They're not a paragon of corporate events has
indeed,
come to life.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes, yes. I mean, it's led to very bad decisions, hasn't it? I mean, reform of bad practices was blocked by the employee-supported chairman who worked against shareholders and his own chief executive to stop jobs from being cut and work and time limits from being raised, ultimately harming the firm itself. I mean, can that be viewed as a success story?
I mean, I think it sort of... an isolated company. I mean, I think the sort of the real thing that's obviously been appalling at Volkswagen, and I mean, I don't know what's going on with other. I'm not completely up to speed with the emissions testing more generally, but it's obviously the sort of cheating around that, and both the it seems that both the worker directors and the some of the big shareholders were kind of. You know, they certainly didn't put a stop to it. I'm not sure how much would be advisable to say in public, but they that clearly wasn't a sort of big great moment for that.
So is this you rolling back then on your?
Well, I think it's for that publication, we went to Germany and spoke to a number of companies about the model of corporate governance they have there with the worker directors involved. And one of the companies we spoke to was Volkswagen, where they suggested it worked very well. We spoke to another number of other big companies as well, Deutsche Bahn, DHL, E.ON, the energy firm. And in general, I think German industry is considered to be, you know, it's the German industrial system is said to be pretty good. In some ways, it the German economy outperforms the US, the UK, etc. In some ways, it sort of doesn't do so well. But in general, we heard from shareholders and workers and academics alike on that trip that they liked the system of worker representation on corporate boards in Germany. We spoke to a guy who had been with E.ON and Deutsche Bahn and with an American firm that bought a German firm, initially fought tooth and nail to get out of the requirement to introduce worker directors, but after a couple of years actually ended up implementing the same system for their American operations as well as their German. So I think the sort of Volkswagen clearly is not a good advert for the German system of corporate governance. You can point to, you know, Carillion, the banks, etc. in the UK that maybe aren't a great advert for our system.
But Len, surely it's right, isn't it? Because if we've spoken in detail about the various polls that there are that show that people have this real appetite to get a better lot for those at the bottom, wouldn't better worker representation on boards be a way of resolving that? Perhaps not in the way that it's been done in some German companies, but
I think there are real worries about having workers on boards. Interesting, you were talking about the benefits of the German system. Of course, many economists would argue that the great strength of the German system is in fact being the Mittelstand, that is the SMEs, the smaller businesses, which don't have this kind of representation, rather than the large companies where co-determination is the rule.
I think they would have to on... if they're over 250 employees or something.
But it's the smaller companies, which has historically been the big attractive feature. Having worker directors in the UK, I think it's problematic because they would almost certainly be dominated by union reps. That's the way the system will work. They'd be based on some kind of election and the unions are organised and so on. That's not necessarily always a bad thing, but you can think, you know, the history of British industrial relations has not been a great one. And to let representatives have a strong influence on board, and Jeremy Corbyn has talked about a third of boards being made up of worker representatives. And I think what would tend to happen in that situation is the CEO's pay will be largely irrelevant because the worker directors would be much more concerned with issues like restructuring, like the pay of people at the bottom and things like this. And I think this would lead to real problems in the effectiveness of these companies. So I would not go down that route at all, quite honestly.
I wonder, to end, Len, if you would briefly sum up what you would like to see as the outcome of the current debate on high pay. What would be your ideal?
I think people ought to think much more carefully about what a free market means. It does not mean a market which is fixed by crony capitalism on the one hand, which we talked about, Luke talked about, but nor should it be something which is determined by the diktat of politicians who have not got a great record for running the public sector, let alone the private sector.
And Luke, that same question to you. Briefly sum up what you would like to see as the outcome of the current debate on high pay.
What we aim to bring about is a sort of change of business culture that's more closely aligned with the interests of wider society, where the sort of mentality of business leaders is that they're thinking day to day not just about how to generate returns for shareholders, but how they can be a sort of force for good in society, including how they contribute to income distribution within their companies and across the economy.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You can let me know what you think by tweeting at IEA London. You can also check out Len's report, his publication rather, on the IEA website at iea.org.uk. And you can also find more films, podcasts and reports on the website. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, and thank you very much for joining me.